Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hi, thank you. You must have my son's phone. He's always losing his stuff.
Actually, we have your son.
What?
I said we have your son, and we'll kill him if you don't do what we say.
Hang on.
All right?
No.
Look, lady, you're not in charge.
No, I said, hang on.
You need to stop talking and start listening, or this will be the worst night of your life. You hear me?
What's going on?
They have Jared.
Damn right we do. And here's what's going to happen.
Oh, if this is a joke, it's not funny. Who's talking?
I'm going to give you a figure, and I suggest you write it down.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Streaming, a Decoding TV podcast. I am David Chen.
I'm Patrick Klopik.
Each week, This Week in Streaming will cover a show that's new and interesting in the world of streaming. We'll tell you if it's worth watching, and if it is, we'll review and spoil and discuss the entire season of the show. Today, we're going to be discussing Full Circle, a six-part miniseries written by legendary screenwriter Ed Solomon and directed by Steven Soderbergh. It's currently streaming right now on Max, the one to watch for HBO. Next week, we're going to be covering Twisted Metal right here on Decoding TV. So that should be a lot of fun as well. You can watch Twisted Metal on Peacock and hear Patrick and my discussion of it sometime next week. So that's what's in store for you. And finally, I wanted to mention one scheduling note. Typically, we cover Justified City Primeval here on Decoding TV as well. That episode usually comes out on Wednesday or so. This week it's going to be a little bit later due to scheduling reasons. So just wanted to give folks the heads up. That is still coming, but it is just going to be a day or two later than usual. Sorry about that. But it couldn't be avoided. You can find more episodes of the show at podcast.decodingtv.com. Email us at decodingtv@gmail.com. There's also many ways to reach me, as I will discuss momentarily, because somebody DM'd me on Instagram their thoughts on Steven Soderbergh's Full Circle, which I will discuss today when we get to it. So what we're going to do today is we're going to talk about our overall thoughts on Full Circle. We'll do a brief recap of it because it would actually be really extremely challenging to do a full recap of it. Yeah. And then talk about some specific topics that came up during our viewing of Full Circle. So, Patrick Klepek, on our last episode of Decoding TV together, we talked about the finale of Secret Invasion, and we commented on how it feels really weird that all this stuff, Secret Invasion is coming out, seems like no one's watching it. I feel like I haven't heard anyone talk about Full Circle. But this is a Steven Soderbergh-directed series, one of the, in my opinion, one of the greatest filmmakers of our time. I remember an interview that Steven Soderbergh gave a while ago where he lamented the current state of our media-saturated environment, and he talked about Jonathan Glazer's film Under the Skin. Did you ever see Under the Skin?
One of my all-time
incredible film. Incredible film.
Just so creepy. Every time I think about several different sequences in that movie, it sends shivers down my spine. Fantastic film.
I remember reading an interview with Steven Soderbergh where he said, I feel like if Jonathan Glazer's Under the Skin came out in the 80s or 90s, we would have spent a decade talking about that movie. Like, it would have been like, they would have been one of the most remarkable works of the time, and we would have spent a decade talking about it. Now, because there's so much, and he gave this interview years ago. So, like, now there's so much stuff. Now we have a Steven Soderbergh show, Full Circle, six-part miniseries, super ambitious show. Feels like the budget's quite high. Some of the great, amazing actors, and yet, other than the fact that I force you to watch this for Decoding TV, I feel like no one is talking about it. So, all that said, I think let's start with the question of: do you think people should watch Full Circle? What did you think of the series overall?
It's to your point. It's very confusing. It's a very convoluted plot. I think it's a hard sell to. In that regard, mm-hmm. Not because you can't track it moment to moment. I think it is absolutely engrossing in the moment, but it's when you start thinking back to all the permutations that led you to this moment in the plot and where it might be going, that it's very easy to kind of lose the thread on what's actually happening, what's occurring on the screen when you're watching it is dramatic and interesting and tense. It's just trying to grasp all of the threads that are happening is very difficult. And so I'm not super shocked that it was also a difficult thing. Like if you know, someone comes to you and says, I want to make a 6-part, you know, TV series, most places are probably going to say yes and find a way to make it work. But then what you end up with is this really sprawling, complex, thematically dense work that doesn't really have a hook. Like when you try to explain like what's in this show, like what's the reason to watch, and you can go down a whole list of incredible performances and actors that you don't normally see spotlighted. Like there's all sorts of really interesting things happening, but it doesn't even by the end, like there are twists, but there isn't like a dramatic gotcha moment that's like, oh, like you watch the show and you get to this moment and like ho. And it's just really good and really interesting, but I think it's difficult to sort of categorize and like, why should I watch this? I don't know that I can boil it down to a single thing, which I think then helps explain why has it been difficult for people to parse, grasp onto? Why did it feel like it just kind of came and went and will be maybe the sort of thing that gets kind of reclaimed in the years to come as more people get a chance to see it and process it. But I'm not super shocked, having watched all 6 episodes, that it didn't really land, because it's not sparkly and shiny, and doesn't really have a lot of that across its 6 episodes. But it was very interesting nonetheless.
I think I'm in the minority here, Patrick, because I feel like I really loved the show. I do agree with you that it is too complicated for its own good. But the parts that stick out to me are the Coen brothers-esque components of it, right? Where it's basically like people have a plan and the plan goes wrong, and then they come up with a backup plan and the backup plan goes wrong. So they come up with a backup to the backup and the backup to the backup goes wrong, you know, like on and on down. And then it's like multiple interconnected stories that keep doing this. So I was a huge fan of it overall, but I think it's hard for me to disagree with anything you said. I think you're right that like, there isn't really a hook, like, you know, come see Rebecca Ferguson kick ass in Silo, you know, whatever it is, like, yeah. Which she doesn't really do in that show anyway. But, you know, like there's some hook of like you're going to see a thing to like Rebecca Ferguson in a big cylindrical thing. Like that's the hook.
And, or even just like Timothy Oliphant, like he, you know, in a Justified revival. It's like, what are you watching that show for? It's like, yeah. Well. I love that, like that character, right? Like I'm here.
Yes.
Like there's something to literally hang yourself, like kind of hang a hat on, like this is what this show is. And then everything else kind of circles around it. And this show doesn't even really have a main character. I think that contributes to what makes it a very interesting work is it's essentially like rejection of like traditional narrative structures that allow an audience to like be guided through the story. Like this show has a lot of characters, but and maybe Sam is its closest thing to a main character, but I would actually say it's just a bunch of important chess pieces that have varying degrees of influence on what actually occurs. But it sort of rejects the notion of here is our main character. We're going to follow them through the 6 episodes. Right. And I think that's a huge part of what makes it fascinating, but also as an audience member, I think can make it tricky to figure out who am I rooting for or even rooting against. It doesn't have traditional heroes and villains. And I think all of that stuff, again, makes it interesting, but makes it complex in a way that I can understand why someone might watch an episode of this and go, I'm not really sure what I'm watching or what I'm watching it for. But I think as a whole work, you get a better sense of what it was aiming for.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's just rare to get a filmmaker this talented, writer this talented, cast this talented, having like seemingly pretty free reign for 6 episodes. You know, like I really strongly recommend it. It has problems that we will discuss, but I do think you should check it out if you have a chance. And you know, a lot of times, Patrick, on Decoding TV, we're trying to like. Hitch our wagon to the star that's rising, you know, Last of Us, Andor and House of the Dragon, right? This is a time where I'm trying to get people onto the wagon, right? I'm trying to get people who listen to us to check out the show so that they can be rewarded by listening to our conversation about it. But yeah, so sometimes we're like we're following the hottest trend. This time I'm trying to say, hey, come join us. Watch Full Circle. And if everyone who listens to this watch Full Circle, we will have increased the audience for the show by about 30%, I think.
Well, and you know, it was a show that I wish more people had watched, because even in the lead up to us having this conversation, because it's so dense, and frankly, if you ask me to sit and explain the entirety of the plot, I've read, there's an article both of you and I have read, and we'll get into all of this, like, that does explain what happened. And then it's just like right out of my brain. Like, I'll read it again. And it's like I'm reading it for the first time. And I say all that not necessarily to knock the story, even though I think there are totally valid criticisms about how it's structured and how it's told. But it's the kind of show that I would have benefited so much from more people talking about it week to week. Like, it was a struggle to even find thoughtful writing about it that could be used as a guide to help me process what I thought about the show. Like, unfortunately, I think the lack of popularity would have made it a hard pitch for you and I to have done episode by episode. But this show, if it were more popular, really would have benefited from having the ability to sit,
right,
and think about it and talk about it episode by episode. Because I actually think it was released in 2-episode chunks.
It was released in 2-episode chunks. Yeah, this would have been a solid classic Decoding TV podcast thing, where it's like every week we cover and try to figure out what's going on, but they release it in 2-episode chunks kind of awkwardly, I would say.
Right.
Very, very few shows are released in like 2-episode chunks. It's not a common thing. So, I agree. But that's why, Patrick, we are the change we want to see in the world.
We
are the change we want to see in the world. All right. Those are our overall thoughts on Full Circle.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
All right, it's time to get to our recap of Full Circle. Now, I do want to warn you, there are going to be spoilers for the show starting right now. So if you don't want to be spoiled, we're going to spoil the show. But here we go. Here's what actually happened in the TV miniseries Full Circle. Full Circle tells a sprawling story, and to attempt to recap the whole thing would probably get pretty boring and confusing rather quickly. So I'm going to tell the story in the broadest strokes possible, but it will mean I leave out tons of details, okay? Here we go. Full Circle centers around two families, one led by Miss Savitri Mahabir, played by CCH Pounder, who makes her living by pulling off murderous insurance scams, and Derek and Sam Brown, who are played by Timothy Oliphant and Claire Danes, respectively, who have made a fortune off of Sam's father's, Derek's, cooking empire. Pretty much every major character in Full Circle is somehow connected to these two families. The show kicks off when Mahabir's brother-in-law, Quincy, is killed, and Mahabir believes it's the result of a longtime curse. To lift the curse, Mahabir commissions a bunch of her henchpeople to kidnap and possibly kill Derek and Sam's kid, Jared. But the kidnapping goes horribly wrong. In a development reminiscent of and inspired by Akira Kurosawa's High and Low, the wrong kid is taken due to a case of mistaken identity, and then due to a separate swap, the kid is not actually killed. Instead, a dummy of the kid is shot. If that sounds really complicated, it was. After that, a bunch of stuff happens. And at the end of the day, Miss Mahabir is apprehended by law enforcement. Several of Ms. Mahabir's henchmen, including Garmin, Harry, and Aked, have been killed along the way. All the children are returned back to their original owners. Timothy Oliphant's character, Derek, has learned some valuable lessons about parental responsibility. And Claire Danes' character, Sam, faces a decision as to whether she's going to turn in evidence she'd previously hidden about her family's misdeeds. So that is where the show ends. So we've talked about how the story is so complicated, Patrick. When it finally pays off in the end, I thought it was mostly satisfying, but it felt like there were maybe a few too many pieces for it to really land with maximum impact. And I guess, how did the plot end up landing for you? And were there plot lines that were more impactful than other? Like, which plot lines made the most impact, if any, at the end there? What do you think?
I mean, I could have watched. Obviously, the show is trying to balance between these different competing narratives with the sort of like the investigation and the family, and then like these Guyanese immigrants and like that sort of like the criminal empire. And each of those could have been their own show. And it was interesting to read, you know, about the making of the show that, like, I guess it was originally written as three different scripts, like from the perspective of each of those different perspectives. And then they were all sort of combined. And I feel like you can see that spider web in the show of like that kind of origin story to the plotting. And so for me, it was like I found every time we went back to these kids struggling to get back to their home, like every one of those characters was like the most interesting part of the show to me. It's not a story that I have seen on screen really before, or you rarely see acting, that style of speaking, that this background given this kind of spotlight. And I just found that really fascinating. It's not that I didn't find the, like, all the stuff happening with the Browns to be interesting, and it's like carried by exceptional actors, but I've seen white privileged people before, and like it's a great, like, I've just seen
it's a wonderful story. It's a wonderful genre. It's a wonderful
it's
genre.
A wonderful what, genre.
White people privilege is a wonderful genre.
Yeah, and it's done well and with nuance, and it is interesting. But I did find myself like all the time as we were like pulled back into their plot lines that I wanted to just go back to more of like, well, how does this like criminal empire happen here? Like, what are the reasons like got these people to this place to make these decisions? And that's the stuff that landed the best for me. I do think it would have been very easy for the show to give that part short shrift and to understandably, given the kinds of characters and storylines we usually see prioritized and like Hollywood narratives, like that the Browns would have been the central focus. And they are kind of the central focus if the story like has any like central like character plotting, but they really give like a lot of screen time and a lot of weight to the motivations and like emotional interiority of all these other characters. And am I spoiling yet?
We're spoiling.
Yeah. Like everything that happens with, you know, like them like escaping and like getting to the plane and like how they feel like trying to get back to Guyana, like all that was just like so thrilling and disheartening and sad and interesting. And so that is all the stuff that I could have watched six episodes that was primarily just like sat with those characters. Probably a harder sell even for these filmmakers and screenwriters to have said that like that's the show they were going to make. But and I think that maybe gets that one of my issues with the show is that because it has to juggle all these characters, and I don't think it necessarily, it gives everyone proper time and weight. I think that's not necessarily an issue, but I do think it might've been a better show if it had chosen to stick with more, like less perspectives given more time, even as though I think the show does a pretty admirable job of making sure that everyone involved gets an actual arc that is maybe not given enough time to resolve. I think like the ending is actually the stuff that feels the most rushed of anything for a show that as long as and sprawling as it is. But I think it sticks the landing pretty well. I mostly just found myself wishing these Guyanese characters were like just broadly given more time, because I found it to be the most interesting plot threads of the whole show.
Yeah, you referenced the fact that the show covers this community of Guyanese people. My co-host on the Filmcast, Devendra, really loves it. He's Guyanese, and he rarely sees Guyanese people depicted on screen, so he was quite thrilled at the fact that, you know, there's a whole Guyanese, you know, a lot of Guyanese stuff going on in this show.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
So I listened to the Filmcast, and you briefly talked about this show, I think first episode or two with your co-host, Jeff Cannata. And then there was a moment where you bleep out Devendra predicting what might happen in the show. Did you do that because was Devendra right?
Apparently, like, the trailer kind of revealed that.
Oh, okay.
The trailer revealed that something that we will not discuss because we're in spoilers, which is that Sam and Derek had involvement in some kind of Guyanese enterprise that went wrong, right? Like,
okay.
When you watch the first two episodes, you have no knowledge of that. You have no idea that.
No,
that's
I didn't see
possible.
A trailer for this at all. Yeah. Like, I went in. I do watch trailers, but this one I hadn't, and so I went in completely blind. And so that's actually kind of a bummer to hear, because the way it's structured and the way it reveals like that additional layer to the show, I think, is better experienced as a surprise, not a twist, but like a surprise, like level of depth to the characters and their backstory than to know that, going into the story.
Yeah. Because when the show kicks off, it seems like it's a random, it's kind of like they've selected this child randomly. Like, but in fact, you find out that there's actually some purpose behind it. And the Mahabirs and the Browns have been like entangled in some way. And I agree, like that part of the plot I found to be the most compelling, specifically the part about like this idea that basically this woman, Miss Mahabir, entraps these guy, like these fairly innocent Guyanese people, and makes them like indentured servants, essentially, because like they brings them to the United States, takes their passports, and then forces them to do terrible things in order to make money to like earn their way into America. You know, that's a very like compelling and upsetting idea that the movie kind of opens with, and you really sympathize with these people who like came to the country like just thinking they'd be coming to opportunity, and instead they need to like murder people in wheelchairs in order to collect the insurance money off of them. You know, it's very upsetting. So I thought all that stuff was really great, and honestly, the stuff that made the most impact for me towards the end was what happens with the two kids. So trying to like get onto the plane, like everything's going wrong. They tried to do the right thing, you know, but everything's going wrong for them, and they're being betrayed left and right, and they're clearly like out of their element. Like they don't know what is going on. I think the characters I'm thinking of are it's Natalia, right? And who is the gentleman that was with her?
That is, I'm looking at this IMDb. Yeah. Let's try and,
is it Gerald? Gerald? Anyway,
I believe so.
There's so many names to keep in mind. I have a full cast list here, like in front of me, and it's still difficult to, explain or understand, but, let me see.
Oh, was it Lewis? I think Lewis was actually the one.
Lewis.
Yeah, that is with Natalia.
Yeah, Gerald Jones, Natalia's brother Lewis, and their friend Xavier. Okay.
Yes, correct.
Okay, so yeah, Lewis and Natalia, like their whole journey at the end, and like how they're trying to escape. I thought that was super compelling, and the most like Coen Brothers esque component of the whole.
Sapped of all of the humor, like sapped of all of the dark, like it's very like it should be, like to make like I feel like often when you say Coen Brothers, there's a often like kind of darkly humorous quality to it that is sort of intrinsic to a lot of the Coen's work. That you're right, that exists here. Except what if that, but just profoundly sad and upsetting like every turn. No laughs to be found in this show, and especially what happens to these characters. But you're right that it maintains that kind of like tumbling down a staircase sort of structure of things like continually going wrong.
Yeah.
But there's no emotional release. Like you don't even get that by the end of the show. Like they get away, but just to go back to the life they were trying to escape in the first place, they just went from a sad situation to a sadder, more exploitive situation. And like you end up with these characters, like you're happy. they quote got on the plane, but they just go back to a life that, you know, they were trying to get away from in the beginning.
I guess better than dying next to the water.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah, like... I agree. Like all things considered, better to be there than where they were, despite the, you know, the glitz of the New York sort of like buildings behind them as they sort of like wave goodbye to America. But yes, better than an a machete in your back.
The other plot line that I think we're supposed to be really invested in Sam's decision about whether or not to turn in her family's evidence. I didn't really feel that compelled one way or the other.
Yeah, Claire Danes doing great work to try and sell me on this. But I think that's actually one of the plot lines that fell flattest for me was sort of the resolution to the Browns, like history with all of this was like, the arc of her feeling guilty over the show and how she processes like the guilt and how she comes to terms with taking accountability for the guilt. I enjoyed watching that arc, but in terms of where it landed at the end, I found it like pretty messy and hard to like get invested in. And it sounds like you kind of ended up in the same place.
Yeah. In theory, it's kind of a cool idea. This idea that this woman did this terrible thing decades ago and then now needs to like reckon with that and undo it. It's just tough that the show is very, very talky. And also this huge decision was made completely off screen decades ago. There's no flashback. There's no nothing to like help you understand what was even going on. Like people are constantly referring to stuff that didn't happen on screen in the show.
Yeah.
And so it's just tough when it's like a huge character's arc hinges on this thing that happened 20 years ago that is for most of the show obliquely referred to.
Well, and it's not even what makes that even tougher. And I think why it makes the show like tough to parse is it's not even something sexy or interesting it's routing number. and a lot of that is what it comes down to. Like, if you could just give me these routing numbers, and that's like dramatically inert. And so absent any sort of flash to the past to like, I mean, we have like children being murdered, like even the bribery, like there were things that could be depicted that I think could have allowed the audience to have a better sense of the gravity. And I think the show tries to do that through these like, you know, these Guyanese characters and this criminal empire, but I needed more of the Browns past if I was going to I don't know the show that necessarily wants you to have sympathy with Sam, but at least to understand her arc. And I'm with you that you're robbed of some of that because ultimately it becomes a show about routing numbers, and that's difficult. I mean, you know, Zazie Beetz is doing like incredible work to get you in, you know, invested in that, in like kind of the acting choices that she makes for her character. But I could have used at least one flashback. Look, one of the episodes was 37 minutes long and the rest were basically an hour. Like add on, you know. 23 minutes that sends us back to kind of like the origins of the Browns history with all this.
The most coherent explanation of this show comes from Roxana Haddadi over at Vulture, who wrote a great piece called Full Circle's Artful End. Frequent Decoding TV co-host Roxana Haddadi. I'm just going to quote from the article because this basically explains what happened for those who are listening and they want to understand, right? Quote, 20 years ago, Sam was involved in a property investment scheme in Guyana with Ranwell, who seized the land of farmers and the underclass, accepted bribes in return for payments made to foreign investors, then abandoned the projects after everyone got their money. Ranwell, who I believe Ranwell is Miss Mahabir's former husband, right?
Yes.
Ranuel killed Clarence's son as an act of intimidation in order to keep the grift going, and that murder and the financing it provided each family has lingered between the Mahabirs and the Browns since. Sam has convinced herself the Essequibo money she used to kickstart her father's career was simply acquired, not stolen, and Derek used that same blood money to abandon another son 16 years earlier and secure his one-night stand's silence. Meanwhile, Mrs. Mahabir used her established connections back home to maintain the pipeline of young and impressionable Guyanese immigrants who work at her various businesses and line her pockets, end quote. So that kind of summarizes why that deal from 20 years ago is so influential to all the stuff that's going on with these characters today. And I was like, when I read it, I was like, this is the clearest articulation of what happened.
Yeah.
That I've seen, including in the show itself, which like doesn't do that great of a job of like explaining what happened, right? So
no.
There were a few like open threads that were like plot threads that were left open. You know, this message comes in from Deep D. And again, there are many ways you can contact us at Decoding TV. DecodingTV at gmail.com is one way you can email us. If you're a paid member at DecodingTV.com, you can comment there. You can also just DM me on Instagram, which is what Deep D did. And she was really looking forward to our conversation about Full Circle. And she says, quote, "I think the first two episodes did such a good job of building up the mystery. But I think the ending of the arcs didn't feel convincing for the characters they developed along the way. I think that was my main beef. For example, Xavier helped Louis and Natalia out in the end. But throughout the show, his motivations were a bit unknown. Whose side is he on? What's his end goal? I just didn't find it believable that he would help them. I also didn't find it believable that Garm and Harry would have trusted Xavier with his family. I felt Claire Danes' character had been really selfish throughout the show. I mean, at the beginning, she was suggesting potentially not even helping Nikki in order to protect Jared. I just found it quite a sudden shift for her to suddenly be willing to go to prison to help other kids." End quote. So those are some of the things that Deep D wasn't convinced by. And I thought it's worth addressing some of those things. You know, like there's a bunch of things that are just like left open. Big question for me. What happened to Xavier's girlfriend in the hotel room? Right. Like, I don't think we ever find out about that. Right. Like he invites her to the hotel room to try to get laid. You know, they get room service. She goes to the other room. And then the Garmin Harry's dudes come in, and that was an amazing scene when they like he opens the door a little bit, and they like take a crowbar to the thing. That was terrifying. Incredible. And then like they cut off the ankle bracelet, and I don't think we ever hear from her again. I don't like is she dead? Is she alive? I don't think we ever hear from her again.
No, yeah, I'm with you. Like it's one of those dangling threads of the show for a show that is as long as it is. It doesn't totally add up why we wouldn't get a passing reference. Yeah. I mean, obviously she's not really a character in the show, right? Like she sort of just exists in Xavier's orbit. But yeah, it is a lot. My assumption was she's dead. Like didn't seem like those guys were screwing around once they got in there. And it would not shock me if she made an unfortunate wrong place, wrong time decision by being in that hotel room with him. As good as the food might've looked.
In terms of Xavier and Garmin Harry, I think I just want to know. I was going to bring this up as a separate topic, Patrick, but I'll say like Garmin Harry was like unexpected MVP of this show for me.
Yeah.
I didn't even this actor was not even on my radar. Faldit Sharma is the actor's name, but he's kind of, in my opinion, the most compelling character in the show because he is the one who's like. He's the one who feels like he has the most to lose.
Mm-hmm.
You kind of think the Browns are going to be okay no matter what, right? So it's like, whatever. But like, Garmin Harry is like, something terrible could happen to him. And he feels like he's actually competent. And he feels like he's like trying to do his, you know, he's trying to figure things out in this situation right until the end when he makes a dumb decision. But until that point, it's good. And you know, the question was like, oh, would Garmin Harry trust Xavier? I think he would because Xavier has been extremely loyal and competent up to that point. Xavier gave a very plausible story for why, like, he has, you know, why, you know, he's in the situation he's in with the detective or the U.S. postal inspector person. He helps to apprehend Manny Broward in the final episode. You know, basically he's proven himself to Garmin multiple times. He's had multiple chances, like Xavier has had multiple chances to kill Garmin if that's what he wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And so like it doesn't strike me as weird that Garmin would trust Xavier by the end. Of course, where Xavier draws the line is you killing his friends.
Yeah.
At that point, he's like, no, I'm sorry, I can't accept that.
Yeah, that was a pretty incredible moment. Like that little because there at least is enough. Like, I didn't think he was going to kill his friends, but the show leaves enough
in
the gap for you to wonder, well, I don't think he'd do it. That'd be like a step further for this character. But it was within the realm of possibility, even though I didn't think it would happen. And the way the show plays with that tension, especially like the actual like setting and location, like it's really dark and you've got this boat and like New York City's. And I mean, it's just really interestingly shot that adds to a lot of the inherent mystery with the character and his motivations and where he ultimately lands. And like he ends up being one of the kind of loose threads by the end of the show.
Because you don't know what happens to him. Like, does he go on the run or whatever? But
probably nothing good.
I think that did they give enough? One of DT's complaints is about like Xavier's motivations. I had no problem with that. Like he felt like just guy who is like trying to balance the different forces in his life and trying to do the right thing. And ultimately he like does the right thing at the end, you know, like he kills Garmin Harry, but he takes care of Garmin Harry's family. Like, you know, like he doesn't want any harm to come to Garmin Harry's family. He doesn't want any harm to come to his friends. So like, he's just a decent guy stuck in a challenging situation. That was kind of my read on Xavier. Yeah.
Yeah. I thought he was exceedingly like, there are people when faced with an emergency, will panic. And that's what we get out of, like, Natalia and Lewis, our two characters who then panic. And Xavier is extremely kind of, he looks at the problem, understands it, makes a decision. Maybe the decision isn't necessarily the best one, but, like, is clear-eyed about what they're doing. And I think that's, like, there's the competence is what all, you know, what is, other than the actions he take, he's just extremely competent. And like, that's ultimately what allows him and his friends to survive to the end of the story are his actions, where he's able to be clear eyed. And that allows him to deceive others into thinking he is loyal. And so I found him to be like an exceptionally like complex and interesting character, because of that. And then given that up against Luis and Natalia, as they're both flailing from plan to plan, trying to do the right thing, but not necessarily thinking through well, what happens on the other side of this? And you get the sense with Xavier that he's thinking about what happens on the other side of that action.
Completely. He feels like he knows, he's planning ahead, and he like has all the angles.
So I choose to believe that while yes, probably tons of great things aren't happening to him immediately after the events of this story, he's so smart. I kind of figure he's going to,
yes,
Xavier,
he's gonna Ethan Hunt this shit. He's gonna get out of this.
He's
okay.
Gonna figure it out. I don't know if he's going back to Guyana or not, but he'll make it work in New York City if he has to.
I had asked you to name some of your highlights from the show, and there were a couple of others that I just wanted to mention real quick. There was a moment when Chef Jeff and his brother Gene reconcile. And that is a relatively minor plot line in the show, I would say. The animosity between Chef Jeff and Gene, and you realize like the reason Gene has hated Chef Jeff for 20 years is because he thought that Chef Jeff gave testimony against him, right? Mm-hmm. I just thought that was really powerful. Like, I saw this show, another show on Max, the one to watch for HBO, called Burden of Proof. And the premise of it's a true crime documentary series. And the idea is that the main character in that show believes his father is responsible for the disappearance and possible murder of his sister. Right? Like, and what does that feeling and belief do to the family? Like, how does that change the family? How does it change? You know, it's a tragic situation, and it kind of felt that way. That was kind of this whole situation too, was like there was basically a misunderstanding, and when they finally reconcile, I thought that was very powerful. Did that moment land for you at all, Patrick Klepek?
Oh yeah, like that specific moment where they realize that the initials have caused confusion over.
Right.
Like the way.
William Sadler is the actor who plays Gene, and it's just, he just like the weight of it hits him, right?
Like he actually is expressionless, right? Like it is,
yeah,
like
yeah.
It is though a person is experiencing, like 20 years of regret in a single moment. It's like, he's staring down an entire, different version of his life.
Yeah.
Where he has burdened himself with this anger and his, and hatred directed at a person that has faults, right? but for the relationship between the two of them would have been fundamentally different as a result. And like that lack of expression that he plays it, like before he, like his brother comes over and hugs him, is just, I mean, the way the camera just stays on, yeah. like it doesn't cut. It just yeah. stays on,
just stays
his
on
face.
His face for like
a
interminably
long time. Yeah. It yeah. feels like it's several minutes before we move on. Cause the only reaction we need in that moment is of this character realizing like their reality has shattered for them.
Yeah. Imagine you've spent like 20 years hating someone and then yes. you realize like, hey, actually it was all a misunderstanding. Like you didn't need to hate that person for that time.
Yeah. Right? And they have like, that little moment afterwards where the last we get with those characters is them like going to a restaurant and like, like ordering food. And that's yeah. a really, kind of sweet resolution to these characters. This sort of sidesteps a lot of their history and involvement in everything that's happening in this show. But for that specific moment, those two characters, what that weight represents, I thought was a really beautiful, beautiful moment.
Yeah. Let's talk about the moral order of the show a little bit. This is one of your topics, Patrick.
Yeah.
Right? Like that resolution didn't quite, it was a nice moment, but it didn't quite sit well with you from like a moral perspective. And can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I think this is tied up entirely like in the complicit like nature of the Browns in like their historical actions that lead to the events of today. I think the show doesn't spend enough time giving the audience a sense of the weight and gravity of that. I think that is highlighted in like the lack of time we are given with Chef Jeff's friend in the park, who is ultimately like one of the like
apparently main... critical to this whole scheme, by the way, we learned.
And is a sense, yeah, like, but is essentially, it doesn't even rise to the level of a plot twist. It is more like, I didn't really put the pieces of that all together till I was like reading about right. the show. Like it sort of just whizzed by. And I think that's where I think the show spends a lot of time with the Browns, but I don't think spends enough time. I don't think the show is conveying that it is trying to absolve them. Like, I don't think that's the show's message. And I want to be clear on that front. I think the show is pretty upfront about like the wrongs these people committed, but I don't think it spends enough time like giving the audience that weight, which I think then helps rob like the moments of Sam like coming to terms with her involvement. It robs what should be a more complicated feeling from the realization over these initials. Like it's like hey, like this is more complicated than just two brothers being upset at one another. And I don't know that the show spends enough time, or and it would have gotten more out of, I think, spending additional time making those emotions, those relationships feel as complex as the plotting to get to the routing numbers does.
Yeah, I think that's accurate. You know, when I finished watching the show, I thought, hey, I felt pretty good about the moral order of the show. Like, you know, I have a philosophy that like that TV shows and films like have a morality, like they have mm-hmm. they are commenting on morality in some way. Like, does the evil person get away? You know, does the evil person get what they deserve? Like, does the good person get what they, you know, like what happens to the good and bad people on a TV show or film tells you what the creators think about the world, I think. And overall, I think the moral order is pretty good. Like it's pretty, it resonates when I think about the moral order of the show. So here are things that happen. I mean, Miss Mahabir is apprehended. She was not a nice person. She was apprehended. Aked, theoretically not a nice person. Garmin, Harry, they've done terrible things. they're killed. Manny Broward, kind of a slimy person, kind of a bad boss. He's dead.
Shouldn't have gone in that house. Soon as he went in that house, like, this is a bad idea. None of this is going to end well for you, buddy.
That's the thing, is like how funny the show is at just very, very random moments. Mm-hmm. And to have like Jim Gaffigan doing a high speed foot chase. I think they really try to play it for laughs, you know, like,
it's a great actor choice to put in that role. Cause I think his standard demeanor disarms the audience to a certain degree, so that when the show adopts, in theory, a more serious tone with like this police raid, like contrasting that against just Jim Gaffigan's whole thing, makes for like a really compelling visual that like produces a lot of humor, just sort of like inherently with the pieces that are on the board on screen.
Yeah. Agreed. Now the Browns is a little more complicated. I think Derek, who's played by Timothy Oliphant, accepts his responsibility for his son.
Mm-hmm.
And that's good. That, like, no argument there. Claire Danes' character, Sam, you get the sense that she's going to turn herself in, and that's also like good, but like it is up to her, you know, like she gets to choose her own fate. And but at the same time, that also feels true to life. Like,
I think the unresolved, the unsatisfying feeling about her lack of punishment is in line with, if this story was real, what would happen. And so, don't get the satisfaction from the storytellers throwing her behind bars and like getting a perp walk. But like that wouldn't happen. And like that whole scene with her and Harmony in the bar, where they talk through what kind of punishment hypothetically, like, would she get if she was to hand her this information? I mean, they sort of end up at probably not a lot, maybe even nothing.
Maybe even nothing.
And that feels true. And I think that messy, so that's why for me, my issue is less with like the moral order of the show, because I think the show is lining up with how the actions would probably be laid out in real life. I just wish there was, like, because we can time skip, like, because the narrative could do whatever it wants to depict events, and it chooses to show nothing from the past, I think we're robbed of a little more complexity and weight to the actions that Sam took when she was younger, and the sort of the benefit that the Browns got as a result of that. Even
you're saying in the form of like a flashback or something like that, something that shows you like, hey, like lots of people suffered horribly as a result of these actions, as opposed to what you do see is like, hey, the Essequibo is like half built and like presumably was a disaster, you know, and human misery has come because of it, but you don't see like the original sin. I do think that Gene and Chef Jeff were like fairly, my sense is that while they were complicit, they were fairly clueless about this, you know, or that they suffered in their own ways. Like Chef Jeff just doesn't seem like he knows what's going on at all about anything.
So his brother took a bullet that clearly has produced a pretty profound kind of like walking disability.
Yeah.
In order to quote cash in, but it doesn't seem like he's had a particularly happy life. Like,
right.
If what you want is justice for an act that maybe was not taken by Chef Jeff's brother out of like cackling maliciousness, like there is a justice in like, he spent 20 years hating his brother, hating himself, and not exactly being able to, waltz around the world in particularly well. And so it's not behind bars. It doesn't change probably the harm to folks who were kicked off their land as a result. But it is, it's not a happy, it's not been a happy life for that character, at least.
Totally. So I think we largely agree, like, morally, the show makes sense or feels true to life. And your only complaint is, hey, I wish we had gotten a better sense of, like, the magnitude of some of these crimes, you know, that they've committed in the past, so that it could land, like, these final decisions could land a little better. That makes sense. So much takes place off screen. I agree. You know, reading the description again, it's like, I can't believe they made Branwell a non, like, on-screen character. That was an odd decision to me. You know, Branwell, Miss Mahabir's ex-husband, like, he mm-hmm. is so critical, but he, like, so much of the show is talking about stuff that didn't happen on screen. Like, to have a character who's not even on the show, you know, I get what they're trying to do. Like, his presence lingers large over the thing, but it's just... It was a little too many, a few too many things happening off screen, in my opinion. Okay, Patrick, you had a couple things you wanted to talk about, right? Hit us up mm-hmm. with one of your topics.
One of the things that I thought was interesting, and I had a question for you, was have you played the video game Immortality?
I have not, but I know of it, and I think I played video games by that creator before. Why don't you describe what Immortality, the video game, is?
Yeah, Immortality is a game that comes from a game designer, Sam Barlow, who'd worked on a number of games that sort of play with a mixture of film and game design, including Her Story and I forget what the Telling Lies, I think, is the other games that Barlow has worked on kind of in this space. And Immortality, which is his most recent work that came out last year, is a story in which you have you're watching clips from three different films from three different eras, and you can click on different objects. It's not clear which objects you can click on. You are just meant to like watch a scene, pause it, and then you can guess like what would happen if you just click on an object and then it cuts to something related to that object. So like you click on a movie slate, or you click on a cup of coffee, and that will have some sort of tangential relationship to something in a completely disparate part of the timeline. And it could be shots from the film. It could be behind the scenes footage of like the people making this film. And it's telling a story with a disconnected narrative. And your job as the player is to start stitching together what is the story being told here by viewing all these pieces cut up separately. And I raised that because I found the narrative of this interesting, especially once I was reading about the backstory of its creation, in which these two, screenwriter and filmmaker, had worked on something I have not played before or used before. Mosaic, I think, is the name of like this interactive work that Solomon and Soderbergh worked on a number of years back that had a sort of interactive storytelling format that like would be in the vein of something like Immortality. And that this project was born out of, hey, we should revisit that. And that like helps explain why there are originally three different scripts from three different perspectives. And because that would make sense if you were trying to like figure out the full interiority and perspectives of all of these characters, and then would allow the viewer slash player to jump between those in some way. And I kind of came out the end of this thinking it was a pretty good show, but couldn't help but wonder, like, especially with some of my issues with the lack of context given to things in the past, the lack of seeing things depicted in the past, and the show's desire to stay in the moment and not sort of like break the timeline, that something like an Immortality or a Mosaic, but like an interactive version of this story could have been really fascinating as a framework to interact with it and to experiencing it, because I feel like a lot of the issues with the story are because it's juggling so many different things. And the idea that as a viewer, you could kind of just pick and choose like where you went on that journey, maybe it doesn't result in something better, but I think it would have been really, a really interesting way to experience this story. And I'm curious if you got that sense at all, watching the show.
It's interesting to reflect on, right? So the idea, you can imagine a story that's like, let's say the show is entirely focused around Xavier, or the show is entirely focused on Garmin Harry, right? And then I'm like, oh, who is this kid they're kidnapping? I'm curious. Double, you know, click on this. And then like,
right.
Oh, now we learn what happened with the Browns and like what their story, you know? And I'm kind of curious. Like, I don't know that, like, I'm trying to imagine like which one of these storylines is substantial enough that on its own, it would be successful. And I don't know that any of them individually are strong enough. Mm-hmm. I think Garmin Harris is the one of the closest. Xavier is one of the closest. And maybe with a little bit more, if they knew they were designing it for that, maybe they could like build it around those characters or flesh those out a little bit. But I agree, it does have the sense of like, oh, we're following this person. Oh, hey, this is interesting. Let's go look at the. And then now we're like in this whole other plot line. So it does feel like that. But I do think that the show does a pretty good job cutting between them. Like I never felt like I was watching something that was supposed to be something else. You know, I felt like, oh, these are interwoven narratives. They're all moving along time at around the same pace. You know, it's not like we're like jumping between them in massive degrees. So but it's interesting to think about. But it's not when I watch it, I'm not like, oh, it should have been three separate movies or it should have been a video game. You know,
it's more that I can sort of just see by knowing its origin story,
right.
I can see how they arrive at this. Like, oh, I can absolutely see how we get here
exactly,
from
yeah.
there. Because I think you can see a lot of that DNA.
The DNA, right. Of like, yeah, we're kind of, it's just so sprawling. It's going from place to place. And, you know, and Soderbergh has made a lot of these, like a lot of Soderbergh movies, a lot of his most famous movies have lots of different kind of protagonists that you're like following around as they go on different adventures. Traffic, the Oceans movies, Contagion, you know, like that's how he structures a lot of his films. But certainly in the context of a video, maybe we should play Mosaic and like, or actually Mosaic is available as a 6-part miniseries.
I think. Oh, so. You can watch it separately.
You can watch Mosaic. Like... Yeah. As a thing. So maybe that's something we should do. Anyway, yeah, the video game DNA definitely, or the interactive DNA definitely feels like it's there, but I do agree, it's a little bit more sprawling than a typical Soderbergh, like compared to like Contagion, you know, which, you know, focuses on all these different families and people. It does feel a little bit more unwieldy than that. And so that might lend itself to being more of an interactive story, but I was a fan of the approach that they chose. Any other topics you want to bring up, Patrick Lepik?
I mean, how did we get this far and not talk about the ponytail?
So you're talking about Dennis Quaid's character's ponytail. He plays Chef Jeff or Jeff McCusker in the film. Tell us what your reaction was to the ponytail, Patrick Lepik.
It's remarked upon once, I believe, in the pilot, in which an assistant or someone asks, like, is he going to get rid of the ponytail? And then it's just sort of unremarked on for the rest of this show. And it's such a distinct visual object. Like, it's such a choice, right? Like, it's just, and it ends up sort of fitting the character who is, you know, definitely portrayed as sort of aloof, not really there. I kind of just chugging along in life. And so the fact that someone like that would choose at their age to wear this sort of hairstyle tracks. And I just found it so fascinating to then read like this interview at Vulture where they don't talk to Dennis Quaid, but they do ask like one of the folks that worked in the costume department, like, hey, like what like was this in the script? Was this in the script? Like, was this part of the character? Like, no. Just like right before filming, like Dennis Quaid said, I think he's going to wear a braid. And they just had to scramble. And then Ed Solomon added a line to the pilot. Like, it was weird enough that the screenwriter was like, okay, it's got it. Fine. The actor can do that. We're not going to stop. We're not going to tell him to not do it. But we have to put in a line addressing the braid because it's too weird for the screenwriter to not at least have it explained or like referenced in the show. And I just found that such a, in many ways, I like the fact that it's not remarked upon. It gets like one mention in the beginning and then is otherwise just this thing that comes into frame every once in a while that you get to appreciate.
You know what I also heard? I think there's an interview that Steven Soderbergh or Zazie Beetz or one of them revealed that the decision for Zazie Beetz' character to have braces on just the lower part of her teeth was up to Zazie Beetz. Like, and I guess I feel like This is why filmmaking is a collaborative medium, right? It's like people come in, you know, Dennis Quaid's like, he should have a braid. Zazie Beetz is like, she should have braces on just the lower part of her teeth.
Right.
You know, and it's like, that's not something that the director could have necessarily come up with, but it's like, but it's like the actor feels like they know the character. And it's, these are certainly memorable decisions.
Mm-hmm.
When you say Dennis Quaid's character has a braid, it's like, oh, that feels right to me. You know, that feels like something that character would do. Zazie Beetz has braces on the lower part of her teeth. Yeah, that feels like that makes sense. I have to say that I didn't love the Zazie Beetz character for the first few episodes because I felt like she was in a different show. Like she was kind of like, I'm in a wacky cop drama. I'm in a wacky cop dramedy. Like, is kind of like how I felt that character was. And then by the end, her character got a lot more serious, I felt, and more consequential. And I ended up really appreciating that performance. But the first few episodes, I was kind of like, what is she and Jim Gaffigan are in like a different show right now. You know, I don't know if you got that feeling.
Yeah. Yeah. And it fit for Gaffigan's character, I think. But for her, well, for one,
she's like hanging out at a gallery with her girlfriend, and she's like, "Oh, hey, yeah, I'll go, okay, maybe I'll meet you up at the drop tonight." You know, like,
yeah. Well, the show wants you to dislike her, like, and that felt like the acting choice as well is to really, it felt overly heightened. It's like,
yeah.
Hey,
yeah,
this is like you are not supposed to root for like this is a pretty unlikable character, and because she's such a great actor, you can't help but keep, like, such a strong performer. And, like, yeah. It's such a specific choice. Like, it's clearly intentional, like, to play this character in this heightened, almost cartoonish sort of way. I just don't think it, like, worked at all for large parts of the show. And it wasn't until the last couple where she takes on this, like, greater, well, like some actual consequences come to the character and like her decisions kind of catch up with her. And
well, and she shows herself to be highly competent, but like by the end, I think, right?
Yes.
Like she puts the whole thing together before anyone, you know, like, and so I appreciated that. But the first part, it was just so like heightened is a great word. It just felt so heightened in the first few episodes. I was like, what is this character even doing in this show? It was really weird.
Yeah. It was like, the audience was her partner, like shutting the door, and it was just like, just shut up, just shut up, like go grow up a little bit and come back.
She felt like someone who didn't take anything seriously, even though she has like a gun presumably and like holds people's fates in her hand, you know, like it felt weird. So anyway, anything else you want to highlight or mention about the Steven Soderbergh series Full Circle, Patrick Lepik, as we wrap up here?
That Nicky kid, real punk, didn't like him.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Real unlikable character.
That was the only thing about the moral order that I think didn't sit right, was Nicky just basically gets everything he wants, right? Like, and like Nicky is like stalking his like biological father and his half-brother. There was kind of this vague illusion early on of like, oh, Nicky doesn't understand right from wrong, and you get the feeling that Nicky is gonna maybe kill someone or something, you know, like do something terrible. Never followed up on. He just gets everything he wants at the end. So that was a little odd, I thought. Yeah
Every time Nicky was on screen, it was like, okay, what is the show gonna do with this? And the answer is nothing. The show's not gonna do anything with that, which is fine. It's got enough going on. I didn't need an arc for Nicky as well, but it was definitely the oddest character in the whole series. And the show didn't really seem to know what it wanted to do with him other than to be a plot device to, you know, get people into certain situations. I mean, Nicky's barely on screen, so it ultimately doesn't matter that much, but it definitely stuck out as pretty odd by the end of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, at the end of the day, I thought it was a great series, really thought-provoking. Chris Yaman is in our YouTube chat right now and saying, representationally, the show is very impressive. There are multiple scenes of Guyanese people and no Americans. They get the names and some of the accents right. There are Asian Guyanese in it. I never thought I'd see Asian West Indians in anything. So it is kind of notable from a representation perspective. And I think we did shout that out earlier in our, mm-hmm. our podcast. But I thought the show was fascinating. Actually, the one big thing that I wanted to mention, I could not find, I could not confirm that the show was filmed on an iPhone.
Which he's done before, right?
Which he's done, but he made a movie called High Flying Bird? Is that what it's called? High Flying Bird on Netflix was shot using an iPhone.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't find that anything about this film being shot on an iPhone. However, my guess is this entire series, Full Circle, was shot using one focal length, is what it seems like. If you're not familiar, basically the
I am not. So please treat the audience like you're going to treat me.
Sure. let me just the layperson's way of describing it might be a focal length is basically how zoomed in the lens is, right? And you measure it using millimeters. So like if you have like a 10 millimeter lens, it's a wider angle than a 85 millimeter lens, right? It felt like the entire show was filmed using one focal length, so one sort of state of being zoomed in, if that makes it one basically a single lens, right? That doesn't have zooming capabilities, and that is I was astonished by it. Honestly, I thought that was amazing. I can't believe I didn't mention it. I put it in the notes. I didn't even talk. I meant to talk about it earlier, but that was by far the most impressive thing about the show to me. I don't know if they used an iPhone. If they didn't use an iPhone, they could have easily used literally a camera that I have in this house, right? Like, because it was all done using one, what seems to be a wide-angle lens. Now, why is that difficult? Like, let me explain some context of why is it difficult. Why is it difficult that Full Circle, or why is it impressive that Full Circle was shot using one focal length? People generally choose different focal lengths to evoke different feelings. As an example, when you are shooting a scene of dialogue, you will want to be at a tighter close-up focal length. Like, so you shoot it at a 50 or an 80 or whatever, because you want to be close, you want to be focused on the person. When you want to show a big crowd scene with a lot of people, you zoom out, you have a wider angle so you can see more, right? It is a very useful tool from a filmmaking perspective to have different focal lengths. To shoot an entire show using what seemed to be... Now, I think there's like a handful of shots that weren't wide angle, but virtually every single shot in Full Circle was wide angle. I paid attention because I was like... when I started noticing it, I was like, this is incredible, right? It's basically removing a tool from your toolbox and being like, I can still make the show. It's like tying one hand behind your back or, you know... I don't know what it would be like. What would be the equivalent in video games, Patrick? It would be like, you know, I'm making a story-driven show. I'm making a story-driven video game, but people can't speak using the letter E, you know, like, or something like, or, it'd be something where it's like, wow, like this constraint is massive. That's a huge constraint to like put on yourself. Scene after scene, Soderbergh is choosing exactly the right angle. He's always like, he knows exactly where to put the camera to do what he needs to do. I'm just like in awe of how good it is. Patrick Klepek, did you notice this at all? Was it a distraction to you? You know, what were your thoughts on like the cinematography of Full Circle?
I'm learning all of this right now, David.
Okay. It didn't even occur to you that like every shot is like shot with like a relatively wide angle lens.
No, it makes me curious to go back to see if I would pick up on that. But I think probably it works on both levels, right? Like someone like yourself that can sit and identify what the filmmaker is choosing to or to not evoke through those choices. Then for a layman like me works on the other side, which is that reaction is happening intrinsically, emotionally, even if I'm not aware of it because of those choices. So I'd be curious to go back and watch.
At times it gets distracting, like, because a lot of it is handheld, and at times you like sense the camera person moving to get into a specific position. My guess is the reason he did it was so he could, like, he has talked about when he shot High Flying Bird on an iPhone 8. He's talked about how what's great about it is it feels like the director and the camera person disappear. Like, there's no one there. Because usually when you're filming on a set, there's like 50 people there. There's like lighters and gaffers and sound people. And there's still sound people in this for sure. Like, sound is an incredibly important part. But just like he can be 5 feet away from the actor when he's shooting using an iPhone, right? My guess is he chose like a wide angle lens on some camera. Could have been an iPhone, could have been like a mirrorless camera, is my guess. I don't know. Maybe Arri Alexa Mini, I have no idea. But my guess is he chose it so he could be like really close to the actors and like working with them in a really meaningful way. But it does get distracting. Sometimes it feels like, oh, they've lost control of the camera a little bit. You didn't notice any of that? Like that didn't distract you at all?
No. But it's like fascinating to hear, a theory of how that impact the filming.
Yeah. I've looked at some interviews with him. I haven't seen him talk about it. So I'm actually like, but it's just like, it's a shame more people aren't talking about this show, because if they were, more people would be talking about the fact that one focal length is used for virtually the entire, what appears to be one focal length. Whether it's one focal length or not, it's the whole thing is shot wide angle. Like, it's either 24, 35, you know, something wide angle for most of the show. And it's like a masterclass in like how you can tell a story using just one, like literally using the iPhone lens on your phone, like the lens on your phone, that angle, you can shoot an entire series and have it be visually interesting. So anyway, thank you for letting me go off on that for 10 minutes. I appreciate it. Okay.
No problem.
You can find more episodes of this podcast at podcast.decodingtv.com. Email us at decodingtv@gmail.com. Let us know what you thought of Full Circle. As I mentioned, Patrick Klepek's going to be sticking with us for the foreseeable future, doing weekly coverage of shows right here on Decoding TV. Next week, we're going to be covering Twisted Metal, which is streaming right now on Peacock. Should be a fun episode. And be sure to check out Patrick's other work at his Substack, patrickklepek.substack.com, as well as at Remap Radio, which I think is at remapradio.com. Right, Patrick?
That's correct.
He is Patrick Klepek. I'm David Chen. You're listening to Decoding TV. Subscribe to the podcast. Follow us on YouTube at youtube.com/decodingTV. Thanks for watching or listening. We'll see you very soon.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.